Welcome back to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers, the podcast devoted to exploring the frontiers of psychedelic medicine and what it takes to cultivate a healthy mind, body, and spirit. As always, Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous. I'm Dr. Steve Thayer. Today, my co-host, Dr. Reed Robison, and I talk about the importance and power of self-awareness. The phrase "know thyself" is often attributed to the ancient Greek philosopher Socrates, but the invitation to examine one's self is found in many wisdom traditions. Reed and I explore the concept from a few angles today. We discuss what the self is that we're seeking to know, various methods of self-inquiry, how psychedelics can be used as a tool for self-exploration, some challenges of developing self-awareness, and much, much more. Got a couple of announcements for you before we get into the episode. If you're looking for professional training pursuant to becoming a psychedelic-assisted practitioner, you can check out the courses we offer here at Numinous. Click on the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/hour-training-selection, and you can use the code PTF10 for 10% off selected trainings. If you're a longtime listener to the show, you've heard Reed and I talk about the psychedelic clinical trial work that Numinous does. If you or someone you know is interested in being a participant in a psychedelic clinical trial, you can click on the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/research to learn more about the trials we're currently running. And as always, if you'd like to support our show, you can do so by leaving a rating or review in places like Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really helps the show, helps boost the signal so that we can get in front of people who would benefit from our content. And of course, if you'd like to email us, ask us questions, give us suggestions, you can do so at ptfpodcast@numinous.com. Please enjoy today's episode. Reed, I got a question for you. Who are you? When somebody asks you, like, describe yourself, who are you? What kinds of things come to your mind?
Ooh, that feels like a loaded question.
So loaded.
Steve.
Double-barreled.
And, you know, besides the reflexive bio elevator pitch introduction that we do culturally, especially in work settings or social settings, to be honest, it's something that I've wrestled with for so long, especially from a couple different frameworks, like, you know, from my yoga approach and also from the Buddhist methods of inquiry and everything that I can't help but these days go into more of a no self kind of answer. I remember one exercise it was like a yoga training where at the beginning of this workshop, the teacher was having everyone write down all the identities and labels they have about, like, father, you know, human, spouse, partner, brother, whatever, psychiatrist, et cetera, and then getting to the place of burning that all away. But what do you say to the who am I question?
I have a similar thought process, you know, like the reflexive ones are, like you described, they're the roles and the labels assigned to those roles in my life, the father, you know, spouse, psychologist, therapist, or you know, interests. Describe myself by my interests. I'm a music lover. I am a, you know, a video game player. I'm a reader. I'm a skier, whatever, right? But then, yeah, you do this process of inquiry, and we're going to talk about different ways to do that today, where you really try to get to know what self is. And then, you know, I have a sad self. I have an ambitious self. I have a less ambitious self. I have a part of me that just wants to sleep all day. I have a part of me that wants to conquer the world or serve the world or whatever, right?
The symphony of selves.
Yeah. We are comprised of many selves.
You know, my answer, and, let's see if I can capture this thought. I won't even try. It may come back to me. This is slightly ineffable territory we're venturing into, but I think suffice it to say that question captures a lot of my path and purpose and this long-standing multi-year journey I'm on that I think will take a lifetime or more to really be able to answer that. Yeah. I think that quest to know thyself, or who am I is at the root of like all our existential wonderings and angst and all the religious ponderings that everyone is doing and spiritual explorations that people do across the globe.
Yeah. Yeah. And it changes in when you were in relation to other things or other people. Right. And then it moves from, like you're saying, who am I, at least for me, to what am I?
Yeah.
Right. And to me, that question leads me into the more existential meanderings and wonderings and curiosities. You know, am I a meat puppet, you know, piloted by a soul that is eternal? Am I just a field of consciousness within which all things emerge and dissolve? Am I a wave or a particle of energy connected to source? And these are, this can be, as one of my graduate school professors say, mental masturbation, you know, just sort of thinking for thinking's sake, and it doesn't lead anywhere. But to me, these are some fundamental questions that are important to at least think about, ponder, because it can have implications for where you direct the arrow of your life, where you put your energies, and how much or how little suffering is involved.
Yeah, I stumbled upon this quote that I think sums it up well. It's a yoga quote by a fella named Rabindranath Tagore in a book called Sadhana.
Cool name. He sounds like a Lord of the Rings character.
Yeah, I think he was. But he said, when a person is unaware of his or her intrinsic relationship to the world, then he lives within a prison whose walls he or she detests. When they encounter the eternal spirit in all objects, however, then one is set free, for only then does one discover the full meaning of the world into which one has been born. One finds oneself as they are in truth and in harmony with the universe.
I like that. Yeah. I mean, to test those walls just made me think of self-hatred or self-esteem. A lot of the things we end up talking about in psychotherapy sessions. And it is oftentimes arbitrary, right? That our negative association with self is a product of early childhood messaging, of conditioning that wouldn't even be present if we simply changed the lens through which we viewed the world and our role in it, our position in it, our concept of self.
And that's the especially tricky part, I think, including how hard it is to do this work when faced with like an episode of serious depression or hopelessness and things, the fact that suicide rates are higher in many parts of the developing world compared to poor countries. Like, why is that? But let me ask you a question. My turn. If you're down, like if you were hanging out with a friend, not in a client session, but just like a course of a conversation, they said to you, Steve, life is completely meaningless. Mm-hmm. How would you respond?
I would say, well, you're right and you're wrong. I would say you're right and you're wrong. I've certainly had that thought before and have gone down nihilistic and we talked about this earlier in our other podcast episode, but nihilistic and absurdist, you know, rabbit trails.
Yeah.
Inherently meaningless. I don't know that I have a final conclusion about whether or not that's true, but there's certainly a way to think of self and the world, that makes that true. It's a tough one because as the people who've thought nihilistic and absurdist thoughts, if life is inherently meaningless, then what's the point? I think a lot of people, at least I will stop speaking for other people to speak for myself. I've had both thoughts. I've had, if life is inherently meaningless, then what's the point? I've also had the thought, if life is inherently at its core meaningless, then it is an empty canvas upon which I can paint my own meaning. And that thought in particular is really encouraging. It gives
empowering.
Me lots of, empowering. It gives me lots of freedom.
I like it.
Yeah. Freedom to decide what's important and make my own meaning.
Yeah. Because what that person was really saying maybe something like life feels meaningless right now. And like you said, we've all likely been there in one way or another, one time. But one thing that comes up for me is like, what do we mean by meaning? Mm-hmm. Like when we ask about the meaning of life, what are we really talking about? Mm-hmm. And one thing I wanted to get your thoughts is, does it mean we're talking about value? Like, you know, when people say life has no meaning, does that mean that their life doesn't have enough value, or there aren't enough worthwhile things to them in their life, perhaps?
That's an interesting take, because to me, value and meaning aren't synonymous. They're not the same thing.
Yeah.
Because you could also be pretty distressed if you feel like the meaning of life has no value, right? You can pick a meaning, and then whether or not it has value to you is a judgment call. And there have been certainly times in my life or roles in my life or chapters in my life where I felt like the meaning that it had was not of satisfactory value.
Mm-hmm. And we certainly know from plenty of people's experience and probably lots of our own that money does not equal meaning inherently. Success doesn't equal meaning. Like when you were rattling off some of those things we all reflexively go to of our identity, like skiing, or I'm a skier, I'm a musician, I'm this and that, those things are all at risk for, you know, impermanence and being whisked away, and us being left with an identity crisis if you break your leg and your identity's very much wrapped up in your skiing abilities.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that, like the Buddhists would say, that's one of the perils of over-identification with a particular role or label or sense or source of meaning, perhaps.
Yeah.
Because it's transient and dependent.
Yeah, I think, like, there are so many examples of this, but one that's front and center for me is like Leo Tolstoy, for example. Even after some great success of War and Peace and like an idyllic home in the countryside with family, kids, but you know, what else could someone want? But he still got to this point of like, what is life for?
Yeah.
Like what, you know, a crisis of meaning.
Yeah. In fact, I was having this conversation with my kids the other day. One of my kids is, you know, he's in his middle adolescence, and it's not atypical for somebody in that developmental stage to have these kinds of thoughts. And I'm listening to him talk about, you know, I'm listening to him grapple with meaning and grapple with feeling influenced by culture and by the state that he lives in and by the friend circle that he's in, and just sort of resisting it, pushing back against it, wanting to make his own meaning, wanting to blaze his own path, and then fretting about the reasons why he feels like he's trapped and unable to do that. And I'll admit there was part of me as his dad that was like, damn it, dude, I've worked so hard to provide you an easy life, to provide you a fulfilling life. Uh-huh. And you're feeling this way. And fortunately enough for me and for him, I was able to catch that and file it away and just sort of be there and validate him. But yeah, I think it's a really common thing for us to go through.
One thing that I think helped conceptualize it for me is like some people have broken it down, meaning what it means. Like there are these four pillars in one framework of belonging, purpose, narrative, and the transpersonal or transcendence. And when we look at those, and we could riff on each of those a little bit if you want, but I think there are some components worth taking an inventory of in our search for meaning.
Yeah. You know, I like those. Yeah. I mean, we could talk about those, because a lot of times when we talk about purpose, especially maybe in this sort of Western world, there's this idea that you will find fulfillment if you align your life with your purpose, as if your purpose was this thing buried in a treasure chest that you had to excavate and discover.
Yeah. It's a trap.
Yeah. I think so.
Yeah. Because the way I've come to realize it more, having gone down that rabbit hole plenty of times, is that purpose is certainly an ephemeral, evolving thing. And, you know, I think it's better described as like just some way of contributing to the the wider world out there, mm-hmm. you know? And like, take for example, it doesn't matter what your job is. Say you're a zookeeper, just to pick a random one, and you're having a crisis of purpose. But it's really not that hard to find like the meaning and the purpose in any job. Mm-hmm. If you're like making the lives of animals better and more meaningful, or if you're, you know, cleaning up some environment and, offering these kind smiles and bright hellos and good cheer yeah. around you, as well as, you know, the beautification of space in the world. You know, there are lots of ways to look at purpose. And I think in any, and it doesn't even matter if you have a job,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. And if you find yourself questioning your purpose in the zookeeper example, it might be helpful to get curious about what's prompting the questioning, right? Are you getting messages from social media, from culture at large that say that this isn't enough, or yeah. that the impact that you're making isn't significant enough? Because mm-hmm. we get messages from culture, both micro and macro culture, about what types of purpose are worthwhile, what have, to harken back to what you said earlier, the greatest value. And often they're, at least in the American Western world, they're economic.
Yeah, and one fiery debate along those lines is around like child rearing. Mm. And you know, as a parent, you know that your contributions in the realm of parenting and raising kids in the best way you can are very meaningful ones, but that's something that can get debated out there in a hustle culture.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I think one of the things you're alluding to with respect to meaning and purpose is that oftentimes we find more robust or powerful sources of meaning outside of ourselves. Right. There's,
yeah,
you can find meaning in building your body, building your mind, building your investment portfolio, and you can derive a lot of satisfaction from those things, but they are very self-focused, and a lot of people find themselves going far down those paths only to turn around and feel dissatisfied with how far mm-hmm. down those self-absorbed paths they've gone.
Yeah. There's this, kind of Buddhist saying or riddle or koan, if you will, of to be is to interbe. Mm. And I find it interesting that this topic, unlike some of the other topics like psychedelic science, integration, like go inward, the meaning making and even these pillars, they all touch into the fact that we are humans coexisting in the world. Mm-hmm. Like, your sense of belonging is a big one, like pillar number one in this framework, purpose. And what you summed it up as, that I think captures it, is like some kind of outward focus for the betterment of humanity. And then even your narrative is about your place in the world and all the events there. And then the transpersonal is connecting with something outside of your limited sense of self.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You just made me think of maybe a useless thought experiment, but if I'm on a deserted island and there are no other beings to interbe with, am I still a therapist? Right.
You lose your license.
I lose my license. Right. If a tree falls in the forest and there's no one around to hear it, does it still make a sound?
Unless you get licensed in that jurisdiction.
that's the solution. It's the license that makes me a therapist. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause it's like, it's all symbolic in the end. Like, look at how meaning making works in the brain. This is a bit of a tangent, right? But it ties into something that keeps coming up in these conversations on other episodes too, is, you know, we never see the world exactly as it is. Mm-hmm. It's filtered through our machinery. Mm-hmm. Like we're visually interrogating the world at all times, and that light bounces off everything in the world, comes in through our eyeballs, lands on our retina, hits the optic nerve, goes to the, you know, the visual cortex, or like the visual centers, which is essentially like a relay center mm-hmm. to a couple dozen other areas. But if you look at like the most, I don't know, the most relevant ones would be like the ventral stream of that just sees shapes and like, oh, that's a hand. You can recognize it. But then the dorsal stream, like on the other side of the brain, that helps put those in a mental representation of where those are in space. Like as you look around this room, you're just naturally taking an inventory. You close your eyes and do a pretty good job of navigating the room with that. And then there's the whole like symbolism. Like, well, it goes into the limbic system as well. This is all happening simultaneously and a zillion times a day.
Right.
So like, what does this representation that we're taking in of the world trigger for us emotionally? And what does it stir up in us? And how does it relate to our narrative that we've constructed inside ourselves?
Yeah. You see this a lot with people who are traumatized and they associate, you know, sounds, people, objects with what happened to them when they were traumatized. And so something that might have a certain meaning to you might not have that same meaning to me because of the context in which, you know, you experience that thing for the first time or during this trauma. So the narrative is very, very different depending on, like you said, how your machinery and then the meaning-making structures interact with the data that machinery pulls in. It varies quite a bit.
Yeah. And the trauma example, I think, is a relevant one. Makes me think of, I think Nietzsche was one to say it bluntly, and probably Kanye as well. But what doesn't...
The two great philosophers.
Yeah, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. It's a triggering statement to me and others, and not something I go around saying, but there is this idea of post-traumatic growth. And it's even in the MAPS MDMA literature and some scientific papers talking about like how do we take trauma, something you'd never wish on anyone, yourself or any human, but it's a part of life too. And how do we, what goes into that fork in the road at a given trauma that can make it into PTSD and debilitating for a time, or turn it into a post-traumatic growth experience.
I think one of the reasons that concept is particularly controversial is because sometimes if taken too far, it puts too much of the onus on the individual. The only reason why you have PTSD and not post-traumatic growth is because you didn't react in the right way, right? You didn't react with a resilient reaction as opposed to a non-resilient reaction. And we just want to be careful about quote unquote blaming people for the way they react to things.
Yeah, but it is...
it's a good example, though, of perspective making the difference, right?
Yeah, and like we've talked about, even in recent trauma conversations, it's not what happened, it's what happens next. And it's really, and from the literature as well, you know, that like some kids, to use a childhood trauma example, will go on to develop PTSD and others won't. And people... like from the social sciences, like one study, for example, looks at kids who experienced trauma and kept it secret had more health problems than those who shared it. So as an intervention in that study, they had young people write out for 15 minutes a day, you know, their emotions, like diving in deeper and deeper and writing about the experiences that were upsetting. And those who wrote it down had much less utilization of doctor visits for kind of mental and physical ailments, right? Like we've seen in the ACE study in some ways of the impact of trauma. But there are interventions, of course, you know, it's why we work in this field, because there are some things that can be done to help turn that more into a growth experience and less into all bad.
Yeah. And one way to think about those interventions is a process of meaning making.
Yeah.
Right. When you were traumatized and isolated and it's just in your mind, unshared, then it can start to be malignant and corrosive, especially if you've assigned blame for what happened to you to yourself. You know, I didn't do enough, or I did something wrong. I deserved it. I brought it to me. Or more global attributions like the world is dangerous and unfair. I need to be careful in this world. And so a lot of our interventions is to dive deep down and draw those things to the surface so that you can complete incomplete, so that you can then complete what were then incomplete emotional processes and relate differently. You know, there's a particular treatment for PTSD called cognitive processing therapy that is focused on this endeavor, right? It combines CBT with some other things, but the idea is that you're trying to help the person get to what are called stuck points, right? Mm-hmm. And these stuck points might be, as I just said, that they, because of their trauma, they've developed a belief about themselves and the world that is inherently self-defeating. So you go back in, you help them tell their trauma narrative and then help them evaluate it and change some of those stuck points. You know, can I reinterpret what happened to me for in the service of health as opposed to staying stuck?
And that's one of the things that came out of that study I was mentioning too, is the writing often landed on these things like, I know now, or because of this, or I now understand, or anything related to insight or rewriting the narrative, which is one of those pillars we were talking about of meaning making. Like, what is your narrative, your narrative identity, if you will, which is the story you have about yourself and your whole life, focusing on the significant events you've been through. Mm-hmm. And those, you know, from this, like, many decade long pursuit by some social scientists, like those who tell redemptive stories about their hard stuff, hard things, they transition from a stuck place to more of that post-traumatic growth, much more likely, you know.
Yeah, and in some cases you see people who have alchemized their trauma into their purpose. It becomes their greatest gift to humanity. So you have the person who, you know, was a victim of childhood sexual abuse who becomes an advocate for other victims, and they dedicate their life to, you know, an ACE study or to serving people and protecting people. So, you know, there can be interesting sources for meaning and purpose in life. And sometimes it's right at the heart of the worst things that happen to us.
Yeah. And some of this literature, I think it's a bit counterintuitive, but some of the academics would call it counterfactual thinking, or this, it's really an inquiry method of questioning or doing those thought experiments of what if I hadn't been through this, but seeing it as like the good lessons and direction that have come of difficult things, or even something like, what if I didn't go to college? Because college was hard and unenjoyable. Like, if someone's saying that, but then if they turn that around and look at, you know, the things that have happened that are positive in their life because they went through whatever it may be, that's a powerful narrative exercise.
Yeah. Powerful and empowering.
Yeah.
We talk a lot about the difference in our work between something that is disempowering and empowering. And some of it, I think, to your point, is a matter of the narrative that you tell, right?
Yeah.
It's a matter of the way you interpret what happened.
And one more thought on the post-traumatic growth front is, I first, I think, encountered that term in the MDMA literature, but it was so intriguing that, like, going back further, I think there were these researchers, Tedeschi and Calhoun, who described, like, what are the ways you can grow after a very difficult experience? And is, like, one is relationships can strengthen, you know, important for our sense of belonging, of course, and meaning. You can go on to discover new purposes or paths, like you talked about, with, you know, having something so formative that you dedicate a lot of your creative effort to it. Third, you discover you're stronger than you think you are, than you thought you were. And fourth, you can become more spiritual, connected to something greater than yourself, or maybe out of that nihilistic place with a newfound appreciation for life.
Yeah. Yeah. The discovering you're stronger than you thought you were stood out to me, because it's maybe pivoting a bit, but it is a reason to seek discomfort, like we've talked about in other episodes.
Yeah.
I can't say that I've thoroughly enjoyed high school football practice, for example. I was often being pushed by my teammates and my coach beyond what I thought was the limits of my physical capability. But I derived so much satisfaction out of the result. Like, oh, if you would have asked me this morning, could I have lifted that weight or could I have run that hill that mm-hmm. many times? And in that time, I would have said probably not. And so I didn't discover that about myself until I was willing to submit to the suffering and encouraged by my peers and ordered to by my my coach. I like that, discovering you're more capable than you thought you were by challenging yourself, stepping outside of the old proverbial comfort zone.
Yeah. And then as another pillar, the sense of belonging is, I think a good one to remember and doesn't just mean having society's idea of a family or a friend group or whatever. Like, it means really being present for, I think, and cherishing those connections and a sense of how would you sum up a sense of belonging in this meaning pursuit?
Yeah, I think, like you were alluding to, I think belonging, for me at least, happens at multiple levels. Right. I feel like I belong mm-hmm. to my family of origin. I'm fortunate enough to have a lovely family of origin that I love. And then belonging to the family that my wife and I have created, belonging to a company like Numinous as an employee, belonging to a community in my local neighborhood, belonging to a somewhat arbitrarily defined community in my my city and state, the country. And then all the way out to the human race, that's never more apparent than on psychedelics, I will add, this sense of belongingness and interconnectedness and the disillusion of the boundaried self and, nature connectedness. Yeah. It's a perspective throat punch. It can be shocking, but also really, really productive. But those are some of the ways I think of belonging. And they can be wonderful. They can also be a source of distress if I feel like by belonging to a community or some kind of group that I then have a responsibility to that group. And if I'm in resistance to that responsibility or feel like it is expected of me, that can be a source of distress.
Yeah. And a source of, maybe as an example or one that's maybe easy to melt away, would be the source of stress that comes from your children, right? But mm-hmm. that you wouldn't question for a second, like the meaning or the purpose beyond rising to that occasion, right?
I mean, that's not to say that as parents we don't sometimes just feel really, really frustrated about being parents, or mm-hmm. if we want to be guilty, real, like some people regret having kids, or there might be those moments when your colicky baby has been up for, 30 nights in a row and you're like, oh my gosh, why did I do this?
Yeah.
But for, at least for me, thankfully those things don't stick, because it's almost ineffable to really describe the sense of meaning mm-hmm. and duty and love that a parent has for their child.
Yeah, it was, I think back in the 1940s, some initial research was looking at the mortality rate in orphanages, like in maybe Eastern Europe.
Yeah, Romanian orphanages.
Yeah, and why were kids dying who were deprived of human contact? They were initially doing that in part to prevent the spread of germs and things, but it was striking. And then more recent surveys looking at close relationships, not the number of your relationships, the depth and how you feel in those relationships being such an antidote to loneliness, and now loneliness being such a kind of a plague these days mm-hmm. that so many are struggling with. There was a fascinating study in the 80s, asked people to recall the number of deep conversations they've had in the last 6 months. And the answer in 1985 was 3, the average answer. 3 deep conversations with, people they care about. And then in 2004, the average number dropped to 0.
Wow. Well, you and I are lucky. We get to have deep conversations and record them and share them with others.
Is that exhibitionism?
Well, maybe. Probably. Yeah, that failure to thrive studies on those orphans. Mm-hmm. I had some friends in college who went out, who they would take these large groups of people, mostly women, and go out and just hold the babies in these orphanages. It's wild to me the connection between loneliness, disconnectedness, and physical health too, like in human physical neurological development. Like you were referencing with those ACE studies, a lot of these traumatized kids who weren't able to share and they feel alone in their trauma not only develop psychological problems, but physiological problems as well.
Yeah, it starts in the womb. Mm-hmm. You know, we're interconnected beings. And then maybe the next pillar, just to touch on it, of the transpersonal or transcendence that we talk about a lot on here because we like it. Mm-hmm. But how do you think, you mentioned it with psychedelics blowing the lid off your perspective of interconnectedness, but how do you view the mystical realm in meaning?
I think it can be a tremendous anchor for meaning and purpose and value when all else fails for people. I was talking about nihilism and absurdism, and in response to your question of sort of what is the meaning of life, does life have value? And I think for a lot of people where their place in the world, the purpose of their life is so ambiguous, difficult to grasp, they can at least land on like a higher being, a higher force, that they are more than just this thing that they identify with here in linear time.
Yeah.
Especially if it's intimate, like I am a son of God or a daughter of God or a child of God.
Stardust.
Yeah. I'm a star seed, right?
Quantum.
And it's, I guess not wrong. We're all made up of the same molecules that were once forged in the hearts of dying stars. But it still is a question of connectedness and belongingness, right?
Yeah. Like if you have ever looked up at the stars at night and realized that you're just a tiny part of a large whole of something, you've had a moment of transcendence, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And who was it? William James, his books over there somewhere, The Varieties of the Religious Experience. Mm-hmm. Good book. Describes it, this mystical experience of transcendence being uncontrollable, lasting, you know, just minutes to a few hours, and not entirely possible to put into words, but has the power to reveal to you truths that may remain with you forever.
Yeah. I had a friend who had a psychedelic experience, and one of the big takeaways was that he was nothing and he was everything. And it was
That's
in
a good
relation,
answer.
Yeah, it was in relation to the sort of the connection to the transcendent, to the ineffable. But, I thought that was thought provoking, you know, who are we, what are we? Well, we are nothing. And maybe in the grand scheme of things, if you zoom out from the earth, there was a YouTube video that shows this, like it shows the scale of the earth. And then it shows the scale of the solar system and then the galaxy. And then, you know, some giant star that's many times the size of our star. And it's just, when you zoom all the way out, it's like, oh my gosh, how insignificant am I?
Like, Carl Sagan's pale blue dot, one of my favorite, perspective realigners or smack in the face if I need it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it can be helpful when you're sort of, you know, stuck in traffic and you think it's the worst thing in the world. Maybe it's not. But also, you're everything. Like, everything that you experience is only in experience. You are the filter through which everything passes that you will ever experience. Your consciousness, like I was saying before, if you are consciousness incarnate, you are the infinite container within which all things arise and fall. And if you want to get less sort of weird about it, I am everything to my kids and they are everything to me. And even though there are billions of human beings on the planet, that can be enough.
See, it's true what your friend realized. I am nothing and I am everything. So then David Yaden, Hopkins psychologist, he was at Psychedelic Science Conference in Denver, heard him speak there, but I have his book on the mystical experience and he talks about this transcendent state is where you realize you're connected to everything and that can melt away a sense of anxiety, give you peace and well-being. And that's kind of one of the biggest places we can draw meaning from.
Yeah. You know, it's, we talked about adult development in a few episodes ago, and a lot of people, we got a lot of good feedback about that. And
yeah,
in that episode, we talked about sort of hierarchies that need to be met before you can maybe have these more transcendent thoughts. So I was just, you know, thinking about meaning-making when your safety needs aren't met, that you might be not be thinking too much transpersonally, although you might be thinking about God and, you know, why hast thou forsaken me type thoughts. But I don't know. I just wanted to name it. It just occurred to me.
I think it's a good point and relates to what we were talking about with post-traumatic growth and the natural processes that need to occur around trauma, stress, and other wounds of feeling the feelings, letting grief, you know, run its course and attending to those crucial bottom of the pyramid needs before, because it would be understandable to be in a place of like of fear and protection coming out of an intense experience and not being able to see like, you know, some of the gifts that are emerging, the diamonds in the rough that that may come eventually or become apparent.
Do you mind if we pivot?
Let's pivot.
How does one get to know themselves? You mentioned the word inquiry earlier. What do you feel like your sort of go-to tools are for getting to know yourself, for exploring self and know self and meaning making?
Yeah, I remember watching The Matrix initially and the scene where Neo goes to see the Oracle and up above the doorway is in Latin, know thyself. And kind of a, you know, a modern interpretation of like what's in the Temple of Delphi and, you know, where the Oracle, this woman, people, kings and statesmen would travel from anywhere. You would never invade a country or colonize a civilization without consulting the Oracle. And it was, but Neo goes to see this Oracle to, because it was, you know, it was kind of a given that he had to know himself to know his destiny and in relation to all the events that have occurred and his karma and dharma and all that good stuff. But to answer your question, it's first, it's been an intriguing pursuit for many years, and the reason for going into neuroscience and then, you know, psychiatry and research. But then pretty soon along that path, you know, discovering meditation or having an experience of a felt sense of some like inner space to explore was just so intriguing. And then from there, it led to yoga. In fact, this morning I was coming out of a yoga studio as the sun is rising, and the person walking next to me is just asking, like, you know, how was your practice? And, you know, it's a normal question, but it was a fun thought of, like, why am I doing this? And it made me think, it was just a good chance to reflect on, I wasn't there for the exercise, although that's a nice side perk, you know, that I don't have to go to Vasa Fitness next and pump some iron immediately to get that fix. But really as a chosen path or system of living that is a path of inquiry stuck with over time and discipline to go to deeper layers on this path of know thyself. And so that, but I think we could get into a little more specifics because I love the idea of self-inquiry, but it's one that confused me for many years. And I'm just starting to kind of feel like I've sorted it out, at least personally, and how it fits into my practices of like insight meditation and things like that. But what are your go-to tools or how do you view self-inquiry?
Well, you brought up a lot of things I want to highlight, like this idea of a practice and of a system, and there being no right way to do this. It's not like, again, you have to discover the right way. It is individual, it's idiosyncratic, but it does help to have a system of sorts or a set of tools, because then another word you used, word you used was discipline. That allows you to bring discipline to the endeavor of understanding and knowing yourself. So I'm just saying that as a preamble to those who are listening. You're going to hear Reed and I talk about our paths. Like, Reed has this one that really intrigued him that's been fruitful in yoga and many others, that you don't have to do what we do. You can experiment and play around and find the one that sort of produces the greatest fruit for you.
Yeah, you need to. And sometimes that means trying on some different methods. Mm-hmm.
So I've tried on a lot. I brought a lot of discipline to sort of my religious faith when I was younger, knowing myself in relation to God, knowing myself as a being who is trying to cleanse oneself of sin through repentance and purify oneself and serve others, really know myself in the sense that I was a son of God on this planet to go through something so that I could then return to my heavenly family, right? That was at least one of the ways of thinking about the religious ideology I was raised in. But then, like you, I got really, really curious about this thing that we call the human personality and consciousness, and why I was experiencing distressing emotional states and self-defeating thinking patterns when, at least in my mind then, I had no right to those things. Like, I had a pretty good childhood with loving parents and a great family, and it was raised in relative safety and privilege. So I started studying and brought some discipline to things like cognitive behavioral self-inquiry. What ways in which am I stuck in self-defeating thinking patterns that are the product of either trauma or, you know, unhelpful conditioning? And can I challenge those things directly, those so-called thinking errors or cognitive distortions? And that was pretty helpful for a while.
Yeah.
And then, got into meditation and more mindfulness-based ways to inquire about myself. Took a bunch of personality tests. Like, personality is a funny one because it's one way that we mental health nerds try to define human beings, but it's really just collections of tendencies, right? That, you know, I'm an INFJ on the Myers-Briggs, or in the Big Five, I'm predominantly open and neurotic, or whatever it is.
A nice tool that can also become a trap, like any nice tool.
Right. But it was, I did do that for a while because I was in a clinical psychology PhD program, and an assessment for the sake of diagnosis and treatment was a big thing. Was I took a lot of different personality tests.
I like those too.
It was interesting, even though they can be traps, to see the through line. You know, there were some consistencies in the ways that these personality types pegged me.
Yeah.
That was thought provoking. And I wondered, okay, well, is this destiny? Is this the way I am and I should just submit to it? Or should I keep trying to refine and transform? Mm-hmm. And so in the service of refining and transforming, I kept challenging myself, kept stepping outside my comfort zone, leaning into what I wanted to lean away from, you know, that sort of interesting paradoxical intention, just to discover what I could discover about myself, and then found psychedelics. And
it's a path of inquiry.
It is certainly that. It's certainly that. All the things I thought I knew about myself were suddenly flipped upside down. Myself, the universe, you know, the transcendent. But as far as daily practices go, meditation, particularly embodied inquiry. So this is actually, embodied inquiry is something we teach in one of our courses. We teach an embodied inquiry course in the service of helping people prepare for and navigate psychedelic therapy experiences.
But there's a cohort going on right now. Yeah. In fact,
one of the things I learned from Devin Christie, one of the architects of that course, was this acronym CYBAM. It comes from somatic experiencing, and it's just dimensions to pay attention to when you're doing embodied inquiry, just pausing mindfully and reflecting. So sensations, so your sensory contact with the world, images in your mind's eye as you're thinking about what's going on right now, what comes to your mind's eye, behavior, sort of your impulse, movement, gestures, posture, affect, so your emotional state, the emotions that are coming up. And then, like we talked about earlier, the meaning that you ascribe to all those things, this sort of cognized dimension of experience.
And inquiry, just for some big picture thoughts of why do this, or what might one expect on the path? I like to turn to one of my favorite teachers, at least from afar, Jack Kornfield, who happens to be a psychologist and a Buddhist, gone deep on the path, both Buddhist and Hindu philosophical paths, but with this idea that wisdom is kind of comes over time and means seeing more clearly as we go and seeing the arising and passing of our experience and how we relate to it. And it, you get there through this gentle inquiry into the workings of the body, like the embodied inquiry, the workings of the mind, like these cognitive ones you're talking about, and this openness, like forgetting what we thought we knew, or at least suspending that, and just being open, like sitting with the questions, living the questions with a spirit of observation and quieting the mind. And then, you know, Jack Kornfield says that as we do the more and more of this inquiry or insight meditation, if you will, we learn more about our desires, see where the root is, because that's one of the at the roots of a lot of people's suffering, the longing, clinging, attachment, you know, whether it's you know, pleasant things or painful things, seeing how it arises affects our life, we can see our contentment and stillness and our place in those. We begin to observe the cause and effect, or karma, if you will, of how we are in the world. And we start to see the impermanence in real time of things, everything passing, changing, and our attachment, our grasping. Like from the Buddhist and yogic philosophies, those are the key ingredients to suffering. Yeah. And so we see what closes our heart, what opens it. And in this kind of state of more stillness and quiet and gentle observation, you know, that's where we learn about ourselves and in our inner world, and see our shadow and our fears, our delights, our psychological patterns and where they arise from, sometimes getting into the where, if it matters. And then into those spiritual questions of like, who am I? And how does that impact how I show up in life? Because, you know, even though those singular psychedelic experiences are these great way showers or path openers, wisdom doesn't, in my opinion, come from one particular experience. It's like a series of like knowledge to be kind of integrated over time and discovery in a spirit of awareness.
Yeah. You're making me think of the things, the most valuable things I've taken from my study of Buddhism, and then the way Buddhism has influenced third wave psychotherapies.
Yeah.
And it's one of the things is this stance of compassionate curiosity, and then letting go of my attachment to needing to figure everything out. So the state, the sort of waveform of compassionate curiosity can be a place I stay. And to stay in it is not to, like I said, to figure everything out and to cut out the things that don't work and only include the things that do, to cut out the things that don't feel good and only include the things that do. If that is sort of to go back to the way we started the conversation, the purpose of life or the meaning of life is to live, that's a great way to do it with compassionate curiosity, I think.
Yeah, I love that. And I chuckle as you share that, because it's something I've realized and re-realized over and over. And I'm glad that I have no idea what I'm doing. And the deeper I go on this path, the more I give up the need, thankfully, to understand or have all the answers, because that's another form of grasping and attachment. And I really do believe the more we kind of discover through these methods of direct experience, the more we realize that you don't have all the answers, and not everything is figure outable by our human brains and human language.
Yeah, you often quote Ram Dass as saying, we're all just walking each other home. And I think another maybe silly way of saying that is that nobody knows what the hell is going on.
So we're all clueless.
Don't take life too seriously. That's one of the things my son was saying. He's like, everyone around me takes life too freaking seriously.
Yeah,
I don't take life that seriously. And I wish they would just lighten up.
Yeah, that, I mean, it's with great you, that he's figuring that out, maybe even ahead of the curve.
Yeah.
So one last thing from Jack Kornfield to sum it up. He says, like, inquiry or insight meditation is a path of discovery. It's straightforward and direct, no frills, gimmicks, simple but not easy. The forms vary, and that's what I discover, is there's so many, like, diamond inquiry method and this and that. Mm-hmm. The genuine practice is the single quest to establish a foundation of harmonious action, to collect and concentrate the mind and body, to see the laws of life by our own true, careful, and direct observation. After understanding the way of practice and realizing that meditative life involves this whole process of awakening, there's only one thing left to do. We have to undertake it ourselves.
Mm. Again, there's that word practice.
Yeah.
To me, it just speaks to the letting go of the attachment to completion, right? Or to perfection, perhaps. We call it a practice because it's a thing that we do and never perfect.
Yeah, it's there's a quote that any Ashtangi would know well, like Ashtanga yoga practitioner, or most yogis have probably heard from Patabi Joyce. It says, practice and all is coming. Mm. Or like it's, you know, 1% knowledge and 99% practice, mm-hmm. the path. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for me, that just allows my nervous system to relax when I think of the meaning and purpose of life as a practice, that I don't have to have it all figured out. I'm betraying all my own neuroticisms here, but neuroses. But yeah, I think this is a good follow-up to our conversation on adult development, on knowing thyself, ways to think about the pursuit and the practice of knowing thyself, its relationship to meaning-making and purpose, to suffering or post-traumatic growth. I feel like we hit a lot of cool points here today.
Yeah, and more to come. This is obviously a big topic that represents more than a lifetime pursuit.
Yeah. Well, thank you, dear listeners, for joining Reed and I in our endeavor to practice.
Thank you, dear Steve. Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure, Reed. Thanks. Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous, a mental wellness company committed to tackling the global mental health crisis by delivering best-in-class psychedelic-assisted therapies, contributing to the body of primary and clinical psychedelic research, and fostering healing through community connection and social responsibility. You can learn more about Numinous at numinous.com. That's N-U-M-I-N-U-S.com. If you enjoyed the show today and you want to support us, here's how you do it. Rate and review the show on platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Subscribe to the Numinous YouTube channel, like the videos, and share it. Share the show or clips of the show with someone that you think will enjoy it. Hey listeners, it's Steve Thayer here, letting you know that Numinous offers unique training opportunities for mental health practitioners to develop their skills and expertise in offering psychedelic-assisted therapy to clients. These courses are carefully crafted by Numinous professionals like myself, Reed, Joe, and others, and offer a variety of high-quality learning experiences. So, if you would like to learn more about these trainings, you can find the link in the show notes below, or you can visit numinous.com/training. That's numinous.com/training. The content of this podcast does not constitute medical advice or mental health treatment. Consult with a medical or mental health professional if you believe you are in need of mental health treatment.